Now, some news about the next census. The Central Statistics Office, the CSO, has said that Census 2027 will be the first census in Irish history where the public will have the option to complete their census online. A massive undertaking, and Eileen Murphy is head of Census Administration to tell us more about this. Good afternoon, Eileen.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Good to talk to you. So the reason this is in the news is that you're doing a pilot scheme with how many people and where?
We are. So before we even finished doing Census 2022, when I was in with you, the government were already taking the decision about what was happening for the next census in 2027. And because we're going online, we've been busy building the systems and getting ready for that. And we received some funding under the EU National Recovery and Resilience Plan to go online and build this online platform. So we're ready to test it, both the platform and some new questions. Because we had a public consultation for new questions for 2027. So we've picked 44 areas in six counties. And if you are in one of those lucky areas, you should have received a letter in the last few days, or it may still come in the next few days over this week, inviting you to take part. And really what we're asking is that people help us by going online and completing an online census form for us. The other change is that it's where you're usually resident, not where you are on census night. So although the 22nd of September is our census pilot night, once you get that invitation, you can go on straight away and fill it in.
Aha. Now, I think you told me the last time that the census and filling in the census form is mandatory, is it? But they're doing you a favour on this one, are they?
Yes. So the census itself is mandatory, and under legislation, you're required to fill it in. But this is voluntary.
Yes, yes. And you say you're piloting some new questions as well. Tell us about those.
We got over 400 submissions for new questions, but obviously we couldn't ask you all of them or you'd be there till next year trying to fill in your form. So we convened a census advisory group, which kind of whittled it down to ones that are really relevant and that should be tested. So there's questions on mental health. So I think in the last census, we always asked, you know, how is your general health? But we're also going to trial a question on how is your mental health in general.
And what will the respondents be offered? Is it just a scale of...
The same scale as what is
okay.
your health
that
we had before. So from very good down to very bad.
Right.
So it's five different categories.
Yeah.
We've been asked to ask where cars are parked overnight for planning for electric charging infrastructures. And as kind of promised in 2022, we're going to test some questions on gender and sexual orientation.
Okay. So how many new questions are you piloting in total?
I've forgotten how many.
Right, okay. Right. Look, you're the CSO.
We've a whole load of new ones and we have changes to some existing questions.
So I wouldn't do Eileen Murphy if you responded. A whole load. How many people drive to work? A whole load of people drive to work every day. Listen, the last time we were talking about the last census and the fact that we were given an opportunity to write a paragraph. So... A message to the future, if you like. Yes, a message to the future.
Yes.
Yeah, time capsule.
Yes.
So what has happened with those? Have they been looked at all or read or what?
No, we promised that we wouldn't look at them like your census form. They're put away securely for 100 years. And in 100 years' time, when they open the archive, you'll be able to see what's on them at that time. But we do know because... some people shared them online. There were some beautiful, heartfelt messages, some funny ones like, has Mayo won the All-Ireland yet?
Yeah.
Some poems and even an original piece of music was written. And because we scanned that area of the form, we know there was something written in about 350,000 forms.
That's what
which
I was going
is
to
about
ask
a
you.
Fifth of the population,
right.
About a fifth of households filled in something there. But as I say, we didn't examine it and we didn't look at what was there.
350,000, you know. So in 21-22, the first eyes will fall on what those 350,000 people wrote in 2022.
Exactly.
Wow. Isn't that spectacular?
Yeah.
Like I don't think you'll be, I won't be around, Eileen. I don't know, I know that's surprising.
No. Well, it might be. Who knows what will happen between now and then.
Well, no, I don't want to be.
Look forward to seeing what was written in 1926, because the National Archives are preparing to release the 1926 census in 2026. So you have that to look forward to.
And were they asked to write a message to the future?
No.
No, no.
Yeah, but I think it's the first census of the Irish state, and I think it'll be really interesting. There was none during the Civil War, so right. Everyone has seen the 1901 and the 1911 census online, and then there was a gap. And so the 1926 census is the next census that we have.
Okay. And the next one for us is the 2027, and this is 2024, and you're doing a pilot on going online. Does that mean that the census collectors or the form collectors, that they'll be a thing of the past, or will there be an option to do it online or hard copy?
No. So we will also be providing paper as before. So not everybody's going to be able to go online, even though we're going to make it as easy as we can, and you can do it on your mobile phone. But if you want a paper form, you can request a paper form from us and we will post one out to you. Yeah. And equally, we will have some people that will be calling to houses after census night to help people if they need any help going online or if they want a paper form.
So that's 3 years down the line. But for 20,000 people in Cork, Dublin, Kilkenny, Louth, Mayo and Offaly in 44 locations, they can be involved in the pilot survey, which is voluntary as opposed to the regular census, which is mandatory. And you're looking for a favour.
If you're really curious and interested and you're not in one of the pilot areas and you want to go on to censuspilots.ie have a look and complete the form, you can do it. Aha. We have a feedback form at the end. And that's what we really want from you, is to give us feedback on whether you understood the questions, whether you understood the instructions, whether the process was easy or complicated, or is there anything that we could do better for 2027?
So just give us that website address again, Eileen.
Censuspilot.ie.
Censuspilot.ie. Anybody can take part. Okay. Eileen Murphy, Head of Census Administration, thanks so much for talking to us. Thank you. Now, there's a new book by Joe Geraghty, Out of Sight, Story of Ireland's Blind and Vision Impaired Sports People. And we have two of the people who are featured in Joe's book sitting in front of me now. We have Paul McCormack, who plays blind golf, and rally car navigator Zara McFadden. Good afternoon to you both.
Thanks for having us, Ray.
Yeah. Hey, Ray, how you doing? How's it going?
Good to see you. Paul, I spoke to you, I met you before as you were in the studio. And Zara, you came into our Galway studio before.
Yeah, definitely a couple of years back now.
Yeah. Why? You just got your licence, but I think that was it, wasn't it? You were in the papers because you just got your licence.
Yeah, so that was back in July 2018. I just got my Motorsport Ireland Rally Co-Driver licence, but I've definitely come a long way since then, so it's great to be back in.
Yeah, and thanks for coming in. And Paul, I listened back to our chat. That was back in 2016.
A long time ago.
So just for people, you're from Donegal originally. You're the youngest captain in the NYPD ever.
Yes.
Yes. And as a result of cleaning rubble away from ground zero after 9/11, you became visually impaired.
Correct.
That's the brief bit of it, yeah.
That's the Reader's Digest.
Yeah, that's the citation version of it. Okay, so Zara McFadden, people are going to be fascinated by you in particular, and we'll get to Paul, but navigating a rally car and being visually impaired, I'd say it raises a few eyebrows, does it?
Absolutely. It's definitely not two things one would ever put together in a sentence when you say motorsport and then some with a vision impairment. But I suppose, yeah, it was something that I always wanted to do, and it was something that I suppose I was lucky enough to get the opportunities put in front of me to take. It's definitely something that I have grown into as the time has gone on. So back when I would have spoken to you first, it was all about just trying to do it and find out would I be able to, because to be honest, I didn't know myself at the time. The answer is yes. Since then, I have gone on to become a member of the Motorsport Ireland Elite Co-Driver Academy, one of five in the country. It's definitely gone from strength to strength, and I've had the opportunities put together by a lot of people. And I suppose in terms of motorsport and what we can offer to people, and it's covered in the book as well, through my role in Vision Sports Ireland, we've also been able to offer that to other people who are blind and vision impaired through our Zero Limits track day as well.
So your family are steeped in motorsport?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up with both of my parents competing in motorsport. My dad is a driver, my mom is a driver and a co-driver. So I think there wasn't much of a chance of me not picking it up. I didn't definitely pick it up from the wind.
And you were born... with congenital problems?
Yes. So I have a condition called albinism and nystagmus. So the albinism affects my hair, skin and eyes in terms of the pigment, and then also a lot of light sensitivity. So when it's really bright outside, I can struggle to see a lot more versus where I'm inside like today. Then I have nystagmus as well, which means my eyes uncontrollably move from left to right all the time and I can't focus that. So the two of them together make the vision impairment. Okay. So I have that since birth. When I was born originally, they think that I actually had no vision at all. And around 6 months, they think I may have got a little bit of it. They don't fully know. So I suppose I'm quite lucky that I do have some vision, and I'm always every day grateful of that. But yeah, that's kind of how it affects it. So when you consider being in a car and the movement and everything that comes with it, it's probably not something you would consider to be an easy task.
No. And when did you realise that maybe driving wasn't going to be an option for you?
Yeah,
what age
so
were you?
I was around 12. So I went in to see my ophthalmologist at the time. And basically my first question was, so like, I won't mind, like, there'll be no problem with me driving or anything. They're like, so they had to break that news that day. And to be honest, of course, at the time I was devastated because I grew up in a house where there was literally cars everywhere. You were trying to get around cars. Dad has now built basically a car park onto our house. There's so many around the place. But yeah, I found out when I was 12 that I wouldn't have that opportunity to kind of follow my parents' footsteps and become a driver, but didn't take me too long to realise on the way out, I was probably not even at the car by the time I asked the question, do you think it might mean I can't be a navigator? And then, yeah, so that would have been around the age of 12. And then when I was 17, I got signed off to get the licence.
So you have a certain amount of vision.
Yeah.
Right. But still, there are huge challenges.
Absolutely. So in the way that my vision would be, I don't have field loss or anything. So I don't have like a certain section of my vision that I don't have. It's just I have all of it, but just not as good as everyone else. So it's kind of like nearly like looking through the back of a binoculars. We can see that everything is there, but it's just not focused, basically. So like I can see that there's writing on the book in front of you, but I couldn't tell you what it said. So it's just basically things aren't as clear for me. So like when you're in motorsport and you're looking at clocks that are far away, I can't necessarily see what the clock is. So you have to think of little things on how we can adjust to that.
I suppose the fascinating thing is that you are telling another person what to do. So their safety is your responsibility.
Absolutely. And I suppose with that, then when it comes to motorsport and being a co-driver, you generally tend to move from driver to driver. So you have to actually go in and sell yourself. So when someone hears that you're coming in, oh yeah, grand, no problem. Oh yeah, by the way, I have a vision impairment. It's something that people go, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. But I've gone on to show that actually doesn't necessarily affect what it is, because I've gone and I've found the alternative ways to do things. So I read what are called, so for anyone who isn't familiar with what a co-driver or a navigator, it's the same two words for the same thing. What I do is I tell the driver where to go, but that's done through very detailed description of the road that we have in advance called pace notes. So I describe them to the drivers. So the pace notes basically is a book that I have in front that thankfully is actually quite accessible. So you can either write them yourself, which is fine because I can make them as big as I like if the driver chooses to do that.
I've done that
or in the past. If the driver chooses to buy them off a company, they actually tend to be pretty large print and bold as it is, because when anybody is doing it, when you're looking at a page in a car, you want it to be pretty big because your head is moving and you're moving side to side. So it's actually something that's probably, without even knowing, quite accessible already, because I don't really have to make a lot of changes. Certain things I found as I've gone on a little bit, I've changed the page colour to be yellow so it absorbs a little bit of the light if the sun is shining. It's not as bright as the white page on my eyes. Little things like that I've adapted as time has gone on. But from that, I read out those pace notes. So it might be like one left and one right and two right. That describes the road to the driver head. So basically it's you get from point A to point B as quick as you can. For the driver, for me describing that, it helps them because it helps them to know how quick they can go through the next corner. Yeah. So I have to be three or four corners ahead at all times.
You're amazing. You're amazing.
I might get some tips from her, because anytime I tell my wife where to go when we're driving, I nearly get the head taken off.
That's a different thing completely, Paul. Okay. So I was saying you left Donegal in the 80s.
I did. Yeah.
And you went over to America and you sprinted up the ladder in the NYPD.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it was. I started off in the South Bronx, the 4-2 precinct as a cop, the 4-6 as a sergeant, the 4-5 as a lieutenant. Then I got promoted to captain with 9 years on the job and became the commanding officer of the 41st precinct.
At 29.
Fort Apache. Yeah.
Oh.
So, yeah, it was pretty quick. I hit the test all in the right at the right time. And it was a great time. I mean, for me, coming from Donegal, I grew up on a small farm in Donegal in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s. It was the Charlie Haughey tighten your belt strap era, where it was a really bad recession. And it was either emigrate or go on the dole. I had the good fortune of having an American passport, so I emigrated to New York. And for me, after, you know, working in Donegal on a farm, it's very hard work, you know, and but getting into the police department, it was a dream come true to me. A lot of fun.
So you're captain of a precinct and 9/11 hits, and everybody knows what happened there. You were part of the team that were clearing the rubble.
Yeah, I spent 3 months down there.
So this wasn't part of your job. You were volunteering to do this, is it?
No, it was part of our job.
Part of your job, right.
Yeah, no, it was all hands on deck.
Right.
Right. It was basically our precinct stuff kind of like stopped. But we were doing probably 16, 17-hour shifts 7 days a week down there. And it was, you would go down to Ground Zero. You would help out. You'd have a skeleton crew at your precinct. And you'd work down there, go home, get some rest.
And the work and go right was back what? At it. Putting bricks into wheelbarrows and wheeling it off-site? Or
pretty much, yeah. We were a bucket brigade, clearing out the rubble. And then it was eventually got to securing the site. It's hard to describe the amount of devastation that was. When I first saw it, it was breathtaking. It was sad and it was breathtaking, the amount of devastation. Because usually when you drove down to Lower Manhattan, you would always use the Twin Towers as your, you know, as your geographic pointer to know where you were. And driving down there, they just were gone. It was a dust cloud and they were gone, and it was heartbreaking. And but to see them, it was like 50, 60 stories of just a mountain of rubble, of bent steel and crushed concrete. And I looked at that, we're never going to get out of this. But it was an amazing job that was done by the first responders, by the rescue workers, by the city of New York. I always say it, I was never, ever more proud to be an American than I was at that time, right? It was...
Despite assurances from various people, there was a lot of dust, a lot of chemicals. Nobody had any measure of this because nothing compared to this had ever happened previously. There was no plan, no patrol guide procedure for this.
You handle other jobs, you've always got something in our New York patrol guide, but this was unknown to us.
And as well as being the youngest captain ever in the NYPD, you were also a sharpshooter, so you had a very good shot, and you went in twice a year to show how good a shot you were.
Well, everybody does in the police. You got to get requalified twice a year up at the range up in the Bronx. And It wasn't until 6 months after 9/11 when I went to requalify that I noticed I thought my goggles were fogging up, and I started missing a few shots, and I was like, what the hell's going on here? And just my vision just started deteriorating over the next 4 to 5 years, to the point where I couldn't shoot and I couldn't drive anymore. If you can't shoot or can't drive, you're not much use as a cop, right? So I had to retire. And you know, for me, it was...
And were you compensated?
Well, you know, you got your pension from the NYPD, but compensated, no. I mean, like, you got your health benefits and you get your pension from the New York City Police Department. Right. But aside from that, you got to live your life.
And were you ever told that there was a direct relationship between what happened to your eyes and clearing Ground Zero?
Well, I have a hereditary condition.
Right.
And what they believe is the... chemicals brought it on. The chemicals and the toxins and the dust brought it on. So they'll never know.
Yeah.
There's like, I'm part of the, annually I go to the Mount Sinai, the hospital in New York, the Mount Sinai. They have the 9/11 medical monitoring program. And there's, I think, 70,000 people go there every year because there's a lot of people dying every week from cancers and diseases that they've contracted while working there. And this is 23 years later.
Wow.
And it's actually, a lot of people don't know it. And we're having an event to commemorate 9/11 this year in Dublin and in Cork, Cork City Hall. My wife and I set the exhibition up, our Ground Zero exhibition up in Cork City Hall. We set it up. So it opened today, but we're officially opening it on 9/11.
Yeah.
And thanks to all the Lord Mayor of Cork City and everybody down there, Barry and Kieran and everybody. But they treated us very well down there. And anybody who wants to go, and it's open to the public now down there. But one of the things we're doing, Ray, is we're planting a survivor tree to honor the victims and all those who have died since then. And a wonderful It's a 9/11 remembrance garden in Kinsale, County Cork. They planted 343 trees there a year after 9/11, one for each firefighter that was killed. And we're planting a survivor tree from New York there on September 11th this year.
Great. So, you were very active before you played GAA and all that sort of thing. So sport, in a way, was taken from you when you lost your sight. You returned to Ireland. Five children, is it?
Five kids.
Yeah. Your wife's originally from Dublin, so you returned to. And then life was going on. And how did you get into the golf?
Well, you mentioned Joe Geraghty there. My kids go to, when they were in national school, they went to St. Fintan's National School up in Sutton.
Yeah.
And they had a fundraising golf outing. And one of the teams was a man short. And it was the morning of the golf outing. They said, "Paul, listen, would you mind coming playing golf with
us?" And you said?
I said, "Jesus, I couldn't hit snow over rope. I haven't hit a ball in 13 years. I can't see it."
Yeah.
And they're like, we need you to fill out the team. So I went and I played. I had four or five pars that day, and I ran into Joe Geraghty, and Joe, who's visually impaired, big sportsman himself, was on the board of Vision Sports Ireland. Said, why don't you play blind golf? I'm like, blind golf? What the hell are you talking about? And it's like, my reaction is the reaction a lot of people get when it comes to blind and visually impaired sports. There's a lot of people probably listening that have no idea that there's sports out
there.
Well,
the Paralympics are on, so they, yeah. You know.
Well, they don't really, when you say Paralympics, a lot of people, don't, like there's two wonderful athletes representing Ireland tonight, you know, best of luck to them in the finals tonight. But again, a lot of people don't have no idea that the resources in sports are out there for their children who are visually impaired. And for me, having been such an avid sportsman, I gave it up cold turkey for 13, 14 years. And it was an emotional experience to be able to get out there and play again.
Yeah.
And
now you've, is it three British Opens and two American Opens?
Two US Opens, three British, yeah. And I won a couple other tournaments. But it's about getting out there, traveling, having fun. I love playing golf. It's a great game. I play up at the Jameson Links up in Portmarnock. I think I'm the only disabled member up there, but they don't give me any quarter up there. And yeah. I don't ask for it either. I'm treated as one of the boys, and that's the way I want it. And it's great.
And I was saying the Paralympics is on, which is, you know, as well as vision impaired, other people with disabilities taking part. And like, it started, I think, for a lot of people in 2012 with the London Olympics and Paralympics and the way it was treated. And isn't it amazing to see what has happened in the last, you know, 10, 12 years?
It's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, being blind or visually impaired can be a very, very lonely place. Lonely, dark place, pardon the pun. But it's hard to beat getting out there, any sport. And if anybody listening here has a child who's visually impaired or blind, there's help out there with people like as a Joe Geraghty, Chris White from Vision Ireland. These are soldiers out there working for us, helping us. They're great people. Mm. Joe just became the president of Vision Sports Ireland, and He did that wonderful book on highlighting brilliant sports people.
Out of Sight is the book, Joe Geraghty. And Sarah, you work with Sports Ireland.
Yeah, with Vision Sports Ireland.
Sorry, to spread the message as well.
Absolutely. Like, it's our role. We're the national governing body for blind and vision impaired sport. We're also, as Paul mentioned, a subsidiary of Vision Ireland. So it's great for us, I suppose. We're there to try and spread the message that sport can and is accessible to people who are blind and vision impaired. So whether that's through programs, events, training, education opportunities for coaches. So if somebody is within a club and they feel like, oh, we have a vision impaired member, or we know somebody, or that we run training, education opportunities, we have courses, we can do specific things. We have training and education manuals for people. We do a range of different things. It's our job to make sure the sport is accessible to people and to make sure that people who are blind and vision impaired can take part in a sport or physical activity of their choice. And that's so important. And there's 60 plus chapters in that book that are all from a range of different sports, whether it's golf or athletics or swimming or motorsport or whatever that is. We see that in Ireland we have such high success rates with vision impaired sport, and we want to keep that up and make sure that people who are blind and vision impaired have those opportunities.
Mm. And unlike Sarah, Paul, you had full sight.
Yes.
And lost it.
It sucks, but it's life. Yeah, and you gotta get on and live life. And I mean, I'm thankful because, as I said to you earlier, there's a lot of friends of mine and people that I've worked with that are passing away every week from diseases and cancers and stuff that they've contracted from working at Ground Zero. So I thank God for what I have, and I try and live life to the best that I can every day. Mm. It's life is good. And if we get Donegal to win an All Ireland, it'll top everything off.
And what about are your contemporaries still in the NYPD and working away?
Say that again, Ray.
Your contemporaries, lads that you joined the force with.
A lot of guys I joined are really high-ranking members of the force right now. There's two of my friends that became police commissioners in the NYPD. So a lot of my contemporaries are high up in the NYPD right now. And I'm glad to see it. It's great.
Yeah. How does Sutton compare to New York?
It's a lot slower, but it's nice. It's a lovely area, Sutton by the Sea. It's fantastic. Yeah. The people up there are wonderful. And it's a great place.
And what age are your children?
My oldest boy is 20. He's actually in college in St. Bonaventure in upstate New York.
Right.
And my twin boys are 18. They're at Belvedere and Glensdale Abbey. They're doing their leaving cert this year.
Right.
And my youngest boy is 16. He's also at Belvedere.
Right.
And my beautiful princess of a daughter is 10 years old. She's at Sutton Park School up in Sutton. Love her to bits. She's the best.
Right. Five children. When's your next race, Sarah?
I'm not sure at the moment, to be honest. So taking a little bit of time out. So I did a lot of championships altogether. So as for the next one, I'm not 100% sure, but I have no doubt and very soon doing a bit of volunteer stuff and supporting where I can and all of that side of things as well, because I think it's great to get the opportunity to do from both sides of the car as well.
And Paul, before we leave you, just remind people of what's happening with the tree and everything, and what are the things, events that people can attend?
There are. There's 40 plus firefighters coming over from the FDNY. They're coming over on Friday. Actually, Thursday they're coming over. And they're doing a charity cycle with the firefighters from Ireland. They're going from the 9/11 Memorial in the Phoenix Park. They're cycling all the way down the East Coast through every firehouse, and they're winding up in Kinsale on September 11th. So they're doing it for Avine's Pink Tie, which is a great cause for a charity for the kids with cancer in Ireland. It's a wonderful cause. But they're going to be going down the East Coast, and the event is on September 11th in Kinsale in the evening. Everybody's welcome to come to it. It's a very emotional and wonderful event.
And the book that features Paul and Zara is Joe Geraghty's Out of Sight, and Jason Smith's story is in there as well, and I think about 35 other stories as well of people who are vision impaired and blind and taking part in sports. Thanks, Zara. Thanks, Paul. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, Colette O'Hagan, who's sitting in front of me, is set to become the first woman in Ireland and the UK to run 1,000 marathons. That's 26.2 miles by 1,000. 1,000 marathons. I'm going to say it again. So at present, Colette is on 996 between now and the Dublin Marathon at the end of October. She has to do three more. And then the Dublin City Marathon this year will be Colette's 1,000th. Good afternoon, Colette.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
I'm lost for words.
Oh, really? It's not like you to be lost for words. I really got you there.
Well, I'm just doing the maths on it. Like, that's 26,000 miles before you add in training. And you only started running late in life, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't start till I was in my 40s when the kids were a little bit older and stuff like that. And I didn't like it at all. That was my story. I always tell everybody that I hated it. I thought, how on earth can anyone do this stuff? But I had a good husband and he kept persisting and taking me out, and we were running up and down the Shore Road in Dundalk for quite a while, and a little dog beside us and stuff like that. And eventually I got the hang of it. I said, some fella in the car wound down the window says, "Oh, Larry, she's beating you now." And he says, "That's it, Colette, you're on your own now.
Off you go. So do you mind me telling them what age you are?
Oh, not at all. My saying is, I don't deny my age, I defy it.
I love that.
Do you like that?
Yeah, it's two fingers to age.
Yes, exactly.
So every marathon you do is...
Don't let that old woman in. No, just don't let her in.
But it's brilliant. So every marathon you do is an act of defiance.
Exactly.
I love
that. Yeah, that's it. You just say, no, I'm not giving in. No, it's not, nothing to do at my age. I'm going to keep going. And I always say start. And I don't come here to start. I come here to finish.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to Larry then. So in your 40s, how many children do you have?
Well, that's a long story with us. Like, we have five children and we also are
We'll talk about that later.
But so five kids. And so when they were a little bit older and a bit on their feet kind of stuff, like the 6-7 years of age and stuff like that, I took to running then,
because I got sick.
I got very seriously ill, all right. And it was sort of a malabsorption, kind of an illness. I don't know what it was. I just wasn't absorbing my food.
Right.
And everything was kind of going the wrong way, like, and I was losing a lot of weight. And then one doctor in particular just copped on to what it was, and he sorted me out. And I honestly could say that's a long time ago. I actually haven't been really sick since.
Since, right. So Larry goes to you, you're recovering, recuperating.
I am recovering from illness, and he says, oh, come on out for a run. And right. I'm going,
and was Larry a big runner?
He wasn't a runner at all. No, he could hardly run a bath, never mind run. Right. But anyway, he was very fit because he was a squash player. He was a good quality, you know, he's a high standard of squash, so he would take the odd wee trot out and, you know, up and down the show road for just for his fitness level, not not mad. So that's how I started. It was the running up to the show road and down the show road and that kind of stuff.
And he thought, your loving husband, that this would help in your recovery.
He did indeed. Now, I don't know what way he was thinking, but maybe he was trying to kill me, but it didn't work.
So as you said, at the beginning, you were having none of it.
Oh, I was having none of it. No, I just said, no, this is not for me. I do not know how anyone does. I was so unfit. And I had been playing badminton previous to that. I took up badminton when I was in my 20s. And I was reasonably fit then until I got sick then. And then kind of things that went a wee bit haywire and stuff like that. But I really wasn't fit.
Now, it's a big leap, right, from running up and down the shore road with the dog and Larry of an evening to heading towards your 1,000th marathon. So what happened?
Well, then what happened was I decided then at that time, because I was in the early 90s was when I did my first marathon in Dublin. So it would have been probably 89. I joined the group of women called the Joan Brady Joggers in Dundalk.
Right.
And they were running, they were training for the women's mini marathon.
So you're in your 40s, early 40s.
Just in my early 40s. So Joan and them, we were all training for the women's mini marathon, which was a great and still is a great event.
Yes.
And this is where I got my running journey from. Uh-huh. So I owe the mini marathon a lot. So Joan would take us all out and we'd all train. And then I did the mini marathon that year and I finished that finish line and I just stood around and I looked and I said, there's no finish line. This is not the finish line, because I knew I had more in me. So I decided I would do the Dublin City Marathon. Now talk about going a big step further.
Yes.
So at that time, you didn't have any gadgets or gizmos or any of those things or gels or things like that. So I decided, how do I train for it? Because I had no idea. I hadn't a clue. So the Irish Runner was a great magazine at the time.
Frank Greely, and they
had a great programme in it every year to train for the Dublin City. And they still have it.
Mm.
So that's what I trained on, that programme. I put it up on the back door, the kitchen back door, and now I was looking at that every weekend, go for the long run, make the dinner, off I go and do my long run and come back and have my dinner then. That's what the way I did it. And I stood on that start line, Ray, and I hadn't a bloody clue what I was doing there. But I got there and I settled in after a few miles. And then I came in and it was just in under the 4 hours.
Right,
which to
good.
Me, like, I hadn't
very
a clue.
Respectable, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of was and it kind of wasn't, because they were all very fast then. They were all freaking doing sub-3s and I always thought I was so slow.
Back then, it was a different...
It was different.
Because there was, I'd say there was around 6 or 7,000, if there was.
That's
that.
That's all, yeah, yeah.
And it was mainly runners.
It was mainly runners and very few women.
Yes, very few
women.
Right.
Very few women. It was 10% women.
Right.
And now look at it. Isn't it fantastic?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Oh, it really has come on in leaps and bounds. And I'm delighted. I was delighted when I seen all these big Martins coming along. And Ireland at the time only had Dublin and Belfast.
Okay.
That's all.
Now, that's one marathon in 1 year, right?
Yes.
So how does it go from that to, like, you could describe it as an obsession, could you?
Well, I actually think if you don't have a little bit of an obsession in it, you wouldn't stick it.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
There has to be a bit of madness here somewhere.
Right.
So anyway, yeah.
Well, I
know what you mean, though. There is a bit of an obsession and probably a little bit of an addiction.
Yes.
In a sense. Like, you do get a wee bit addicted. But what happened was then, I kind of did Dublin, Belfast for a couple of years. And then my husband says to me, well, again, I'm going to blame him again. He says, why don't you go abroad and run? And I said, but look, I'm not a good runner. You have to be really good to go abroad.
Yeah.
No. He says, go pick somewhere. And I picked Boston, of all places. So Boston was my first one abroad. And I did that with Sports Travel International. That was a great guy.
Yeah.
Martin Joyce had that set up. And they look after everything.
That's
where I really, really fell in love with the marathon.
What was it about the Boston one?
I think it's the way the Americans treat it. It's like you're an elite runner.
Uh-huh.
Like, you're, oh my God, you're doing the marathon and all that kind of stuff. And I loved it so much that I wanted to do more. So I started going over then to the UK a lot because there was a lot more Martins there. And I met up with the UK 100 Martin Club. And Ray, I got contaminated totally. Totally, that's where it all right. started. They told me about all these Martins you can run in
and
a year.
And they were saying you could do 100.
Yeah.
And you were aiming towards 100. And here you are now aiming towards 1,000.
And then, that's exactly what happened.
Now, we'll go back to the running, but I just want to go to the fostering.
Okay.
Because how many children have yourself and Larry fostered
over
the years?
Well, we've had at least 80 kids coming in and out our door. I call it the open door or the revolving door, because you'd have one child in and another one would go out and another would be in and that kind of thing for years that went on. And do you know, Ray, I get very emotional when I talk about the kids because I really, really love those kids. And I dedicate myself, and so did my husband, we did our best for every child that came in our door. And we have wonderful stories. We could write a book on all the stories we have from the children.
Why did yourself and Larry decide to foster?
I was that kind of a nurturing kind of a person because I grew up in a big family. There was 18 of us.
18?
And we grew up on a farm and a shop on the border between Louth and Armagh.
Yeah.
And my mother was a very busy woman. She was a very hard one, which is very busy woman with all the kids, but she was also a very hard working woman because she was on the farm, she was in trying to nurse the babies and stuff like that. And I loved nursing my I loved looking after the babies. And you know what? It kind of got me out of the work for doing the farm work.
Where were you,
you
in the 18?
I was probably midway.
Right.
Yeah. And
many of the 18 are still alive, Colette.
Oh, God, there's a lot of them gone. And the funny thing is, there was 10 girls and there's only 3 of us left.
Ah, right.
And funny enough, it's nearly all the girls that died and none of the lads.
Right.
So I don't know now where we went wrong there.
Yeah, because that goes against the average.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. So I love looking after the babies in the house at the time. I was just my idea. And it also got me out of working in the farm. Because I got off peeling, digging the potatoes.
So cleaning
nappies and all that.
preferable to digging spuds.
I think I got my nurturing neighbour kind of feeling there with the kids, like looking after my brothers and sisters.
You don't do anything by halves, do you? 1,000 Martins, 80 foster children.
Is
there anything else we should know about?
I'm doing that on their behalves. No. I've got a thing about numbers, don't I?
You do, yeah. People will recognise you because you we're up at the top of what they call Heartbreak Hill there it used to be Bank Holiday Monday, now it's the Sunday, which is brilliant. And you come up and the hair always matches the running gear. Yes.
They'll know me for the pink.
The pink. You're the pink lady.
I'm the pink lady. That's what they call me, the pink lady, because I love pink. And I always feel when I'm wearing pink, there's something calming about pink.
Yeah.
So I'm a calm kind of a person. I don't get really rattled too easily, you know. But when I do, like, my kids used to say to me, "Mom, I've never, and this is God's truth, I've never heard you raise your voice at ever." And my kids will tell you that. And Jacqueline, my daughter, said, "Mom, you never raised your voice. I never heard you shouting at us." And I said, "No." And she goes, "But you had a look." And she said, "Well, we got that look. We knew we were in trouble. That's all you had to do. You had to just look at us."
When you go on your long runs, do you scream?
I usually sing.
Do you?
Yeah.
And do you use it for you time? You know, do you use it to...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's my go-to time. Oh, yes. My God. The amount of problems I've solved out running is unreal. I might have trouble with some of the kids or I might have a problem in my head. And how do I solve this? Out on the road, solve it, no problem.
Right.
It was great. And I came back a better person because I had my me time and I could calm. So it done me the world of good, just going out running, calm my mind down, thinking of how I'm going to solve this problem. Maybe it's some troublesome child or something, you know yourself. And
it always looks better after a run.
You never regret going for a run.
I was going to say
you do regret not going for a run.
Now, 996. So you've Kilkenny, Monaghan. Then Galway Bay is 999
with the fabulous Ray O'Connor.
Right. And then October 27th, is it this year?
October 27th is the 1,000.
1,000.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The big news, and we said it already, Colin Farrell is running the marathon as well.
I know. God, will I get to meet him, I wonder.
I might know somebody who knows somebody.
Oh, thank you, Ray. Thank you, Ray.
I'd say if Colin knew...
All the women would be jealous if I get to meet Colin.
I'd say if Colin Farrell knew that the Pink Lady was doing her 1,000 marathon, he would be searching you out as opposed to the
opposite way
around.
I met your man, one of my favourite actors a few weeks ago, Brendan Gleeson.
Ah, what a man.
Because I'm running for the hospice.
Yes,
he's the patron of the hospice. And I was telling him, like, that
Saint
Colin
Francis.
was running. training and all that. And I said, would you think I'd get to see Colin? Oh, to see, you never know, I might be able to handle
he
that.
Well, he knows better than I do.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's because they've been in a number of movies together, haven't they?
He was very good. He was really nice, lovely man. Very down to earth.
I hear you have Colette O'Hagan on your show today, a special lady with a heart of gold, a hero and a friend. She has written her story for Dublin Marathon issue, The Irish Runner.
Aha, that's right, my story is in
and,
the Irish.
Colette also has a gold medal for the World Championship 24-hour event for the most distance covered for her age. Tell them how many miles you covered in 24 hours, because we have to go very quickly.
98 miles in 24 hours. That was when I was in my 60s, because that was my age category.
Colette O'Hagan, we'll be cheering you on.
Thank you so much, Ray.
You're more than amazing. Thank you so much.
And I hope to see you now up on the hill.
Yes, if I'm not running it.
If Colin's ahead of me, tell him.
Yes, the Pink Lady's coming up behind you. Cormac's on Drive Time.